Frida, It Runs in the Family is the title of your book, and your parents are Elizabeth McAllister and Philip Berrigan, and you grew up in Jonah House. Tell us about your parents and what is it that runs in the family?
Well, what runs in the family is a commitment to justice, a desire to see the world, a desire to see the world be better than it is right now, a desire to see the end of war, the end of racism, the end of economic inequality. And what runs in the family is a belief that it's not the systems or the people in power or the institutions that are going to do that, but that people are going to do that, and people working together are going to enact that change. So Phil Berrigan and Liz McAllister were activists against the Vietnam War, against nuclear weapons, against racial inequality in the United States. They found each other when both of them were inside of religious orders. My father was a Josephite priest, and my mom was a religious of the Sacred Heart of Mary nun. And they met and fell in love while both being really committed anti-war activists. And then once they got married, they kind of looked at the anti-war movement and realized that it had been really, you know, of course, the people of the United States were a large part of the reason that the Vietnam War ended, and huge, you know, protests in the streets and a lot of political ferment and fervor, but that people burned out really fast, and that it was really hard to sustain a high level of commitment, that people went, you know, had to get back to the business of raising a family or having a job or pursuing a career, or that just it was hard. It was like people took time out from their lives to do social and political justice work instead of seeing that as integral to life. And so they formed the Jonah House community in Baltimore, and that's where my brother and my sister and I were raised. So I think the values that they instilled in us and that vision of a kind of different tomorrow are some of the things that run in our family.
You had some Kalamazoo connections too, though, didn't you?
I do. My brother went to college at Kalamazoo College. Mm-hmm. And met his wife, who's a Michigan native, there at Kalamazoo College. And then when they got married and decided to raise a family, they chose Kalamazoo as their home. And with another couple who also went to Kalamazoo College, they formed Peace House, which is in the East Kalamazoo neighborhood there. It's a Catholic Quaker community on Phelps Avenue or Phelps Street, I don't know, mm-hmm. That particularly serves the children and young people in their community with a safe place to play and tutoring and academic support and just being sort of positive influences in their lives.
Now, I don't mind telling you that reading your book, I lost some sleep. I was up all night reading. It's absolutely fascinating.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, don't be. It was fascinating. Well worth it. Well worth it.
Thank you.
Now, your background, as well as I believe the way that you've chosen to live today, your lifestyle now, is a poor lifestyle to taxes. Is that true?
Sure, yeah. When we were growing up, our parents and the rest of our community painted houses mm-hmm. To make a living and did that kind of recognizing that that was work that everybody could be a part of, that it was, at that point, it was something that people just paid cash for pretty much under the table. It allowed my parents to be war tax resistors, so not paying pretty close to 50 cents on the dollar of the taxes that are paid, federal income taxes, go directly to the Pentagon. So removing some small degree of complicity from that, they decided to be war tax resistors and to really live outside of the formal economy. And that's not quite how my husband and I are doing it, but we're a family of five. We live very well on his income as a social worker and try and make a lot with a little. Mm-hmm. We make a small enough amount of money that we don't pay federal income taxes.
Keep yourself in that lower tax bracket, in other words.
That's right. And we try and grow some of our own food, and we just try and live as simply as possible. So there's a kind of a funny piece in the book about us, buying our fruits and vegetables from the get rid of it bin at the supermarket, and and that kind of being similar to the dumpster diving that my brother and sister and I grew up doing. They're spending a lot of time.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. There's almost like a movement now, isn't there, of dumpster diving, of people, as part of recycling and an incredible amount of food waste and waste
right.
of other
I mean,
things.
It is incredible how much food is wasted in this country at the same time that so many people are going to bed regularly hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of quest for perfection, right, that says that, once a banana has even a little spot on it, it's no longer good to eat, is really really wasteful and really damaging. And so, dumpster diving has kind of become this cool thing, which is not something I would have ever expected when I was 12 years old and, inside
that
of a dumpster.
You were starting a fad.
A food terminal.
Yeah.
So,
well, actually, I can admit that I went dumpster diving once with my son just to see what the heck this is all about. And I actually came home depressed because I found with him so much good stuff. And it's just incredible what we throw out. So growing up, your parents were behind bars quite a bit, and this is not because of what we would usually think of as criminal activity, but because of being on the picket line so frequently. What was that like for you and your siblings to grow up with one or both parents, at one point both parents, being behind bars?
It was very hard. It was very hard. And I write in the book about a period of time when I was two going on three and my brother was one going on two, where both of our parents found themselves in prison at the same time. And it was only a few months, but it was a very difficult time for us. It was possible because we were living in community and there were other people, a part of the Joan House community, who were able to step in and, were familiar with our routine, loved us deeply. We were comfortable with them. They were able to take care of us. But in preparation for the book, I went back and looked over the letters that my mom in particular, but both of my parents had sent to us that were read aloud to my brother and I on a daily basis. We received letters from them. And just hearing the pain of that separation in my parents' letters was really provocative for me, because I think as a child, I had a sense that they were going to jail, kind of totally happy, not happy, but prepared and resolute and strong, mm-hmm. And never really questioning if we were going to be okay. And this was our work, to be at home, to be little kids, to be good while they were gone. This was our piece of the piece work, so to speak. But, as an adult, I could kind of and now as a parent, I could really hear how painful that was for them, and how grateful they were to us, even as little kids, that we were shouldering this burden. They continued to go to jail for their peace witnessing, for demonstrating at the Pentagon, at the White House, at nuclear facilities throughout the country, at military installations. But they worked very hard after that one period when we were quite small. They worked very hard to stagger their arrests and their court appearances and their jail time so that we were never without one of our parents. And as far as I can remember, they were successful in that, well into our teenage years. But jail was kind of part of our growing up. We spent a lot of time visiting one of our parents in jails and prisons. We wrote a lot of letters back and forth. My siblings and I are all real correspondents, old-fashioned correspondents. We have stamps and envelopes lying around ready to mail letters to people, in large part because that was such a part of our communicating with, you know, these principal people in our lives. So you know, our dad got out of jail for the last time, you know, just a year before he died. And so that continued to be a part. Those peace witnesses and the consequences of those continued to be a part of our lives with our parents. You know, my dad just right up until he got sick in 2001 and died in 2002. And then our mom has continued, you know, to do peace witnesses and to risk jail time. Most recently, at a drone facility in upstate New York this past summer, and at the Pentagon this past fall.
Have you done any time yourself for similar reasons?
You know, I have been arrested a number of times for peace witnesses at military installations, and then in Washington most recently as part of a group called Witness Against Torture, which is trying to shut down Guantanamo and end the practice of torture. And it's just sort of a fluke that none of those witnesses have resulted in jail time. I've been held overnight, and you know, but I haven't been sentenced to jail time.
What typically is the charge? I'm just wondering how that works. Are they felonies?
Oh, nothing that I have been arrested for is a felony charge. They're, you know, they're misdemeanors, that trespassing, failure to obey a police order.
I see.
My favorite thing that I've been arrested for on the steps of the Capitol is haranguing and incommoding.
That's a charge.
those are the charges, haranguing and incommoding, which basically means speaking out and refusing to move.
Wow. So at what point did you rise up to take up the cause yourself? Growing up like this, were you brought into it as a child already, or was there some transitionary point? A lot of children rebel against their parents no matter what their parents are doing. And then at some point, did you decide, wait a minute, what they're doing makes sense to me too?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think youth rebellion is a major trope in our culture, and I have often been asked, you know, how come you're not just automatically a Wall Street day trader or a arch Republican with the Tea Party or something like that? But I think that the thing that our parents did really well is really giving us a piece of the work, a piece of the piecework from a very young age. They couldn't have done it without us. And we were exposed to all of the information, to all of the stories, to all of the, just all that they felt as people of conscience and as responsible Americans. We got all of that from them from a very young age. We went to all the demonstrations. We went to all the meetings. We were participants. We were never observers. And there were certainly times, particularly when I was a early teenager, where I would have really loved to have sat it out. But that wasn't our family culture. And I do remember sort of being at the White House, maybe as a 13-year-old, and you're kind of seeing like families of, you know, like well-dressed, happy families coming to the White House, having their picture taken, you know, in that iconic sort of spot there, with the fountain and the White House in the background, and then just kind of heading off to the next tourist destination, and feeling like I really wish that was me as I was standing there in front of the White House for an hour with a sign and getting a sunburn and, you know, wearing secondhand jeans and all of that. But I think the real moment that I started to own this legacy and see it as really important to me was in high school, as a junior, the United States began the first war against Iraq, and I, you know, with my classmates, was going to candlelight vigils in the lead up to the first Gulf War, and then I remember standing there, you know, the night that the war started, you know, and it's tomorrow, isn't it? 23 years ago, tomorrow, January 17th, 1991, I really felt like this was something that I had something to say about. And then, you know, my peers looking to me for, you know, where's the demonstration happening, and, you know, how do we rent a bus to go to Washington and participate in the big demonstration there, and really feeling like I had something to offer, and something that was, you know, respected and like wanted, you know, even by the cool kids in my high school. And so I think from that moment, I really felt like, you know, this wasn't just something that had been placed on me by my parents, but something that I was actively sort of choosing and pursuing and wanting, you know, for myself to have this voice, to have these positions and these values, and to be, you know, committing my own life to working to make sure that another, you know, generation of young people in this country don't go off to fight in wars, and don't, you know, go kill and be killed, and that our as a nation, that our values are turning, and I think things are, you know, worse off than they were when I was in high school. And so, you know, I think we have a lifetime of work ahead of us.
Well, when you're saying you feel that they're worse off than when you were in high school, then I want to ask you, all of this that your parents have done, all that you've done, and all the people around you, is it effective? Standing on a picket line, all that you've done and sacrificed, how effective has it been through your observation?
Well, I think it comes down to how you measure effectiveness.
Okay.
And sort of objectively looking at the world, and, you know, the war that started January 17th, 1991 is still going on. And it has, you know, rippled and repercussed, you know, throughout the world. And we can see the seeds of it in Paris, France. We can see it in Belgium. We can see it here in the United States. You know, we can see it at Guantanamo. We can just kind of see all of that rippling and cascading, throughout our world. And yet I talk in the book about being inculcated with a sense of moral cheerfulness, and this sense that the work is its own reward, you know, that doing the work is a part of it, right? It's not just about what happens, you know, what we can objectively achieve. And I sort of wonder what the world would look like if there were no peace activists, if there were no people sort of standing up. How much worse could it be if people weren't standing up, sort of building solidarity, standing with the victims, you know, protecting the vulnerable? If none of this was happening, you know, what would the world look like? So there's that. And then there's, you know, what would we look like as people if we weren't trying as hard as we could to see our values and what we believe is important sort of realized out in the world? There's this famous and perhaps somewhat apocryphal story about A.J. Mustey, the great pacifist, standing in front of the White House during the Vietnam War at a regular vigil for peace, and nobody else showed up. And because it was raining and cold, the weather was miserable. And so a reporter comes up to him and says, "Mr. Mustey, what do you hope to change, being here by yourself?" And to which Mustey replies, "You know, I don't do this to change the world. I do this so that the world won't change me." And I think that the value of that cannot be overstated, that by acting, by organizing, by working, you know, we're trying to see something realized in the world, but that we're also realizing something in ourselves, which is that we will not succumb to disillusionment, that we will not get tired, that we will not give up, that we will not let the values of our consumerist culture sort of, you know, just kind of seep into us and, you know, make us people who just go to the mall and, you know, play video games all the time. So I think that that's really important.
So in the end, it's about answering for our own lives, our own selves, our own backyards, and that's what eventually makes a difference in the world.
Yes, yes.
You have a fascinating write-up about Guantanamo in your book, giving us, and I thought I knew a reasonable amount about that. It's been in the news quite a bit lately, and before, but you gave us some insight, the reader some insight about who exactly is in Guantanamo, and it may not be that vicious terrorist that many of us think. You gave us another perspective. Can you share some of that?
Sure. And, I think this is very timely, you know,
yeah.
Right now, as the Obama administration is mm-hmm. Is letting people go from Guantanamo. Five people have just been transferred in the last week or so, with Estonia and, now I'm forgetting the other country. Uruguay has taken a number of men from Guantanamo. They are being released because, for the most part, they are men who have been cleared for release for many years and have just been in Guantanamo in some sort of terrible limbo because the United States can't or won't send them back to their countries of origin. In the case of Yemen, where the majority of men who are currently at Guantanamo are originally from Yemen, it is because the government of Yemen is involved in a kind of a civil war with al-Qaeda identified groups within the country, and the administration doesn't feel like it can return men into that kind of unstable political environment, and that has been the case in a number of other countries. Algeria, for one, where a number of men from Algeria have been in Guantanamo for more than a decade. A number of men at Guantanamo are originally from China, where they're members of a Muslim minority, and were they returned to China, they would immediately be put in prison or face even worse consequences. And so, the United States has faced this sort of conundrum, this puzzle about how to return men who are innocent of any crime, return them to their countries of origin. That project has been made even more difficult by the fact that the United States Congress has said that no men who have been in Guantanamo, even if they're completely innocent, which many of them are, can come to the United States for repatriation here, even when they have ties to this country, even when they have communities that are willing to take them in and make sure they're not a burden on the taxpayers. So there are a handful of men at Guantanamo who have been charged with crimes, who have been charged with acts of terrorism, and there's a military tribunal system set up for them, but it's moving very, very slowly, in part because the United States military and intelligence agencies tortured them. And so information to be used in the tribunal has come from their torturing, and there are a lot of legal questions about how admissible and how verifiable, how true that information can be if it's gained through physical violence and emotional and psychological violence to these individuals. So this is quite a knot that we all have to untangle and have to be about untangling. And so this is a issue that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, a lot of time organizing about, and one that for lots of reasons, including the fact that both of my parents have been in prison, kind of just sits very close to my heart.
What exactly is the National Committee of the War Resisters League and your role there?
Well, the War Resisters League is a almost 100-year-old pacifist organization. It was founded in 1923 here in the United States by women organizing for the vote and by men refusing to be drafted into the military. And since 1923, it is held that war is always a failure of the imagination and a crime and something that should not be countenanced. And so I've been a member of the War Resisters League for, I guess I joined up pretty soon after September 11th, 2001, when I was, living in New York City and, experienced that day, being, right there, a mile or so from Ground Zero, and just watching New York City kind of embrace itself, embrace each other, and put out a call. Our grief is not a cry for war. And the War Resisters League was very much a part of sort of putting that message, our grief is not a cry for war, out, and then organizing against the Bush administration's decision to go to war against first Afghanistan and then Iraq in response to that devastating and terrible attack, which took the lives of 3,000 people in the United States, in New York and Washington, and then in the airplane that crashed in Pennsylvania. So the National Committee of the War Resisters League is essentially the board of the organization, and I have served on that, I think, since 2002. So we meet regularly. We try and organize campaigns and demonstrations. We support war tax resistors and conscientious objectors to military service, people trying to get out of the military, and then do a lot of work against just sort of general peace work here in the United States.
One of your recent columns in a publication called Waging Nonviolence, How I Will Prepare My White Son for the Interactions He Won't Have with Police. Fascinating right. Topic and very relevant today. If you can share something with us about that column.
Sure. Well, I was just, watching, what was happening in Ferguson, Missouri, in the aftermath of Michael Brown's killing there, and then the failure of the grand jury to indict the officer responsible for his death, Darren Wilson, and then watching something similar happen in New York City with the choking death of Eric Garner by a member of the New York City Police Department, and both of these unarmed African American men killed by white police officers. And then the conversations and the demonstrations that happened in both of those places and throughout the country around Black Lives Mattering. And I read this article in which a panel of African-American women, and this happened in Missouri this fall, talked to a largely white audience and talked about their relationships with their children and the discussions that they have to have with their, particularly with their sons and grandsons, about how one has to act. And it was called The Talk, right? And how to act when stopped by police, because this is something that happens to young African-American men. And it was heartbreaking to read all of this, as I'm sure it was heartbreaking to sit in the audience of that particular event that happened. And I thought about how unfair it is that's not a conversation that I'll ever have to have with my little blonde white son, that he, he's very little now, right? He's 2.5, but he loves people in uniform. He loves police officers. He loves firemen. And in our community in New London, which is a very racially diverse community, the police department is almost exclusively white. The fire department is almost exclusively white. There have been campaigns by the NAACP here locally about trying to make both of those institutions more diverse, more reflective of the communities that they're that they're put there to ostensibly to serve and protect. And then this summer, a 31-year-old man named LaShawn Gilbert was tasered to death by our local police department. And he's originally from Bermuda, and so a very dark-skinned black man. And he was visiting relatives in our community, and sounds like he had a psychotic episode. And instead of receiving the medical attention and the mental health attention that he needed, he was tasered repeatedly and was killed. And so my family lives quite close to his family, and we've been a part of candlelight vigils and demonstrations, and then campaigns to put pressure on the police department for some sort of accountability for this. And so just, thinking about what was happening nationally and then seeing that happen here in our own community, just blocks from our home, and then thinking about my little white son, I wrote this column where I sort of imagine the kind of conversations that I have to have with him, which aren't about how to act around the police, but how to stand up for his friends and to stand up for his neighbors and stand up against a culture that says that his life is more valuable than the lives of his black and brown playmates and neighbors. And so just really thinking about what my responsibility is as a white person, as a white mother, the question that panel of African-American women left with their audiences, hey, these are the conversations that we have with our sons about, how to absorb and not respond to racism and to violence, from the hands of the police. But what kind of conversations are you having with your sons who are police officers, your sons who are firemen, your sons who are, in positions of power? Like, how come your sons are killing our sons? Basically was the question that was asked. And I found that a very provocative question. And so I explored that in my column for Waging Nonviolence.
Yeah, that's a great question that we can't just shove off the responsibility on the victims, really. But we all have to look at that question.
Right.
Yeah. So with all of this darkness, Frida, I'm just going to ask you, do you think there's any hope for us? I mean, when we look at violence and greed and corruption and racism and climate change and the list goes on and on, do we have hope or do we just hole up and enjoy what time we have left? Do you urge people to get on that picket line?
We have so much hope.
Thank
we
you.
We have so much hope. I mean, there is so much happening in this country right now. There is so much organizing going on. There is so much ferment. There is so much creativity. There's so many good things happening. And there are so many people taking responsibility for themselves, for their communities, for the vulnerable people in their communities. And the answers and the new policies don't get handed to us on a silver platter. They definitely don't come from Washington, D.C. They come from us. And everywhere I look, I see great indications of that. And so I am hopeful, not in a sort of everything's going to be okay, let's just sit back and, don't worry about it kind of way, but in a like, yep, everything is going to be okay because everybody I know is working as hard as they can on every, on every issue that you could name, there are people working and giving it their all. And when they get tired, there are other people who are picking up the work and carrying it forward. And that's what we need. And we need to We just need to keep doing it and keep doing it with joy and with creativity and with a sense of community and cheerfulness and joy because we're making the road and we're making it by walking and we're doing it together and that's how it's got to be.
So on that bright and joyful note and hopeful note, tell us about your upcoming reading at BookBug on February 5. What can we expect?
Well, I am really looking forward to it. I am really excited to come to Kalamazoo to be with my brother and sister-in-law, my niece and my nephews, and to be at the BookBug where I'll read from It runs in the family on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. So I'll do a reading from that, and hopefully some questions and thoughts will come from the audience about you know, motherhood and about parenting from a position of values and, you know, a desire to see our children kind of pick up this work as they grow older. And I think it'll be a really good time. I hear that the Book Bug, where I've never been, is a gorgeous space and a really important part of the Kalamazoo community. And I'm really grateful that they're giving me a place to share with the Kalamazoo community.
Well, thank you, Frida. February 5 is the event, and the book is It Runs in the Family by Frida Berrigan. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks so much.